I want to start with a date. It's February 14th, 2026.
Okay, Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day, exactly. And, you know, usually the music industry just floods everything with, well, with generic love ballads.
Or heartbreak anthems.
Right. But this year, something landed that just, it completely defied the algorithm. It's an album called Been Waiting Way Too Long. The band is the Merrill Scott Band.
Okay.
And on the surface, it's a debut record. But the
Well,
second you press play, the math just doesn't add up.
it doesn't sound like a first attempt, does it?
Not at all.
There's a weight to it. I mean, usually a debut is about potential. You hear a band trying to find their footing, maybe mimicking their heroes a bit too closely.
Sure, yeah.
But this record, it sounds like a greatest hits collection from a band you somehow missed for the last 40 years.
That is the perfect way to describe it. It feels established. And when you dig into the backstory of Scott and Keith, the two guys behind this, it all starts to make sense. We are talking about a couple of 20-somethings who met in a dorm room.
No. We're talking about a partnership that tracks all the way back to Carmichael, California, in the mid-1960s. So this isn't a debut in the traditional sense. It's more like an excavation.
Excavation is the right word.
Yeah.
Because this music has been buried. It's been living inside these two very different lives for decades.
Exactly.
And to really understand why this album sounds the way it does, you have to look at the geology of that friendship. You have to go back to Carmichael.
The setting really does feel like a third character here.
It does.
The source material paints this really vivid picture of California in the late 60s, early 70s. It wasn't just a place, it was a whole soundscape. And Scott, who handles a lot of the production and guitar now, he started his musical life back in seventh grade. But there's one specific moment, a catalyst, that I think explains the entire architecture of this album.
Okay, what is it?
It's sixth grade, Christmas morning. Scott unwraps a cassette of the Beatles' Abbey Road.
Ah, that's a pivotal moment. And it's not just because, you know, everyone likes the Beatles.
You have to remember what Abbey Road actually is. It is arguably the most structurally sophisticated pop record ever made. The side B medley, the way the songs bleed into each other, the melodic bass lines. It's a masterclass in composition.
And Scott didn't just like leave it on a shelf. This is the image that stuck with me. He had this little portable tape recorder
Oh, wow.
and he would take it on the school bus. Can you imagine the acoustics of a noisy school bus in like 1970?
Terrible.
And there's Scott with his friends huddled around playing that cassette over and over and over every single day.
See, that creates what psychologists might call imprinting.
Imprinting.
Yeah. At that age, your brain is just incredibly plastic. So Scott wasn't just listening to music, he was absorbing a syllabus.
He was studying.
He was studying without knowing he was studying. When you listen to an album that complex, that repetitively, you start to internalize the rules of songwriting without even trying.
So that's where the hooks come from.
Absolutely. You learn that melody should be the primary driver. You learn how to build tension in a bridge. If you listen to the Merrill Scott Band today, that melody-first philosophy is directly traceable to those bus rides.
But then, if Scott is the Beatles' disciple, Keith brings a completely different flavor to the mix, and this is where the sound gets so unique.
Okay.
Keith wasn't just some rock kid, he was formally trained on the trumpet.
Which is a crucial distinction. Trumpet players think so differently than guitarists.
Right. And his home environment was different, too. His dad was a massive Miles Davis fan.
Oh, okay. So that was just in the air.
It was in the air. So while Scott is on the bus dissecting Paul McCartney's bass lines, Keith is at home and kind of blue or sketches of Spain is just playing in the living room.
Yeah, think about the mechanics of that for a second. A trumpet player has to breathe.
Sounds obvious, but yeah.
But it dictates phrasing. A guitar player can shred endless notes without pausing,
Yeah.
but a trumpet player, they have to find the space. They have to find the space in the music to take a breath.
So it teaches you about silence.
It teaches you about the value of silence, and it teaches you to play or sing behind the beat. To let the music kind of float a little bit.
You can totally hear that in Keith's vocals on this record. He doesn't attack the notes. He glides into them.
It's a jazz sensibility, yeah.
Applied to rock music.
It creates a flow rather than a punch. So you combine Scott's rigid structural Beatles education with Keith's fluid, atmospheric Miles Davis upbringing, and you get this very specific Carmichael sound.
It's structured, but it breathes.
Exactly. It's catchy, but it has atmosphere.
So they have this incredible foundation, they're friends, they're musical, they're soaking up the best influences of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
By all logic, they should have started a band in, what, 1978 and toured the world? But that is not what happened.
No, life happened. And this is the part of the story that I think will resonate with anyone who has ever, you know, put a dream on a shelf.
The long detour.
The long detour. They drifted, they grew up, they went into completely different worlds.
And the contrast between their paths is almost cinematic. Scott goes into the tech world.
Right.
Spends decades mastering computers, understanding systems, learning the technical side of how things are built.
Mm-hmm.
But Keith, I mean, Keith's story is the one that really got me. He moves to Long Island, New York.
Okay.
And becomes a commuter train conductor.
It's a profound image, isn't it? The conductor.
I mean, literally punching tickets, walking the aisles.
There's a certain romance to that job, but also a monotony.
For sure.
You're responsible for the journey of thousands of people, but you are stuck on the same track back and forth every single day. But here's the twist. While he was walking those aisles, Keith was writing.
He calls it his secret archive. He didn't have a guitar strapped to him on the train, you know.
No.
He was writing these songs in his head.
Which requires an immense amount of mental discipline. When you write without an instrument, you have to hold the melody, the harmony, the lyrics, all of it in your mind at once. You have to lock it away.
It sounds like the music was just insistent. It wouldn't leave him alone.
I think so. It was so insistent that he couldn't ignore it, even while working this blue-collar job. He was accumulating what the sources call a lifetime of material.
It's the iceberg theory, right? The passengers just saw a guy in a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath the surface, there was this massive catalog of songs just building.
And at the same time, Scott is out there becoming a wizard with production technology.
Mm.
It seems disconnected, but these two skill sets, the raw pent-up songwriting and the high-level technical ability, they were on a collision course.
They were developing the exact tools they would need for each other.
That's it. If they had tried to make this album at 22, Keith wouldn't have had that archive of life experience.
And Scott wouldn't have had the production chops.
Exactly. He wouldn't have had the skills to make it sound professional. They needed the time apart to become the people who could make you place. Been waiting way too long.
So, fast forward to the reconnect. It starts so casually. Scott just asks, hey, send me one of your songs. You probably expected, what, a rough voice memo? Keith humming into a phone.
Low stakes. Just two old friends sharing a hobby.
Right. So Keith sends him a track. It's called It's You. And this song actually ends up as the second track on the album.
Okay.
And this is where Scott's whole background comes into play. He didn't just listen to it. He basically reverse engineered it. He took the raw idea and built a full arrangement around it. Drums, bass, polish, and sent it back.
Imagine being Keith in that moment.
Oh, my God.
You've been hearing this song in your head on a train for years. It's existed only in the abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you open a file, and there it is. Real.
Fully realized.
Fully real. Yeah. It must have been a shock to the system. The source says he was blown away, but I think it was more than that. It was validation.
Totally.
It proved that his archive wasn't just a daydream. It was viable art.
And that was the ignition point. The whole conversation shifted from, hey, this is fun, to we have unfinished business. They realized they weren't making demos, they were making a record.
And that psychological shift is everything. It's the difference between I play music and I am a musician.
Yeah.
Once they decided to capitalize on all that patience, the floodgates just opened.
So let's dive into the album itself. Been waiting way too long.
Mm-hmm.
The title is obviously doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
It frames the whole listening experience immediately, doesn't it? You know you are stepping into a history.
You really do. And musically, the sources describe it as classic country rock and classic rock, but I think that sells it a bit short.
I agree.
There's a texture here that is very specific to that West Coast, that Carmichael upbringing. But the first thing that jumped out at me wasn't the genre. It was the timestamp.
The song lengths.
Yes. In 2026, the average pop song is, what, 2 minutes and 15 seconds?
If that.
We have these fractured attention spans. But the Merrill Scott Band is putting out tracks like Driving Me Crazy, which is 5 minutes and 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
It's You is 5:30. You're Right for Me is over 5 minutes. They are completely ignoring the TikTok-ification of music.
And I think that's a deliberate artistic choice.
Yeah.
It signals confidence.
Yeah.
When you write a 5-minute song, you're asking the listener to trust you. You're saying come into this world and stay for a while. It goes back to that jazz influence and definitely the 70s rock influence.
They aren't rushing.
They are not rushing to the hook.
Right.
They're letting the instrumental sections breathe. They're exploring the bridge. They're allowing the narrative of the song to unfold at a human pace, not an algorithmic pace.
Driving Me Crazy is a great example of that. Mm. It has this driving rhythm, maybe a subconscious nod to the train tracks.
Could be.
But it takes its time building the emotional frustration in the lyrics. It doesn't snap. It just burns.
Well, that's the benefit of being a lifer rather than a rookie.
Yeah.
They aren't trying to go viral. They're trying to tell a story. And you hear that in the lyrics, too. The themes aren't just boy meets girl. The notes mention time, patience, and the quiet hope that love is still worth holding on to.
Quiet hope. That phrase really stuck with me.
It's a very adult emotion. It's not the fiery, explosive passion of a teenager.
Yeah.
It's the endurance of someone who has lived a bit.
Yeah.
Someone who knows that love is work and that waiting is part of the process.
There are 13 tracks on the album, and the sequencing feels so intentional. You know, we start with the title track, acknowledging the wait.
Right.
We go through the highs and lows of songs like I Can't Get Enough of You and Rochelle. But I want to talk about The Closer. The final track is called Right Now.
Which is the perfect bookend.
Exactly. You start with the history, been waiting way too long, and you end with the immediacy right now. It feels like a statement, like we are done waiting, we are here.
It resolves the tension of the album. If the whole record was just looking back, it might feel a little too nostalgic, right?
A little bit, yeah.
But ending with Right Now pivots the energy toward the future. It tells you, the listener, that this isn't some retirement project. It's a launch.
They're active.
They are active artists creating in the present moment.
I want to go back to the sound for a minute. We talked about the Beatles and Miles Davis, but when you listen to a track like Don't Fight the Feeling, there's this shimmering quality to the production. It just feels warm.
That's likely Scott's production sensibilities merging with that Golden State DNA.
Mm-hmm.
In the digital age, it is so easy to make music sound sterile or, you know, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But this album has a room sound to it. It sounds organic.
Mm.
And I think that comes from their desire to recreate the feeling of those records they loved.
They're chasing a feeling, not just notes.
Yes.
Yeah.
They aren't just copying the notes. They're trying to capture the sonic warmth of a vinyl record playing in a living room in 1972.
It's inviting. It's the kind of record you put on while you're cooking dinner or on a long drive. It keeps you company.
Which is the ultimate goal of that genre. It's companionable music.
So we have this incredible story of the conductor and the computer guy finally getting the band back together. But why does this matter to the person listening to this deep dive right now? Why should they care about two guys from Carmichael?
I think it matters because it disrupts our obsession with youth.
Mm.
We are constantly told that creativity is a young person's game. That if you haven't made it by 25, you miss the boat. The Merrill Scott Band is empirical proof that that is a lie.
It's the idea of incubation.
Yes. We tend to view time passing as lost time. But in this case, the time was an ingredient. The 40 years of detour were necessary.
Right.
The songs Keith wrote on the train are better because he wrote them as a grown man observing the world, not as a kid trying to guess what the world is like.
And the production is better because Scott spent a lifetime understanding technical systems.
Yeah.
So the delay wasn't a failure. It was R&D.
Precisely. Yeah. It was a very, very long research and development phase.
Yeah.
And the product, the album benefits from every single year of that wait.
That is such a relieving thought. It makes me think about my own hard drive, you know, full of half-finished projects.
We all have them. We all have our version of the secret archive.
Right.
Maybe you're not a conductor writing songs. Maybe you're an accountant writing a novel on your lunch break.
Yeah.
Or a teacher sketching designs for a business.
And the lesson here is don't delete the archive.
Keep building it. Keep refining it. Because the variable you can't control is when the opportunity comes.
Mm-hmm.
Scott called Keith out of the blue. If Heath had stopped writing, or if he'd thrown away those mental tapes because, oh, it's too late, he would have had nothing to send. He was ready.
That's the key. He was ready. When the door opened, he didn't have to pack. His bags are already standing there.
And that invites a really provocative question for everyone listening. What is in your archive? What is the skill or the passion that you have been quietly nurturing in the background of your real life?
That's a great question.
And more importantly, if an old friend called you today and said, I have the tools to make this real, send me what you've got, would you be ready to send it?
That is something I am going to be thinking about all day. The album has been waiting way too long. It's out now, released February 14th, 2026. If you want to hear what patience sounds like and what a trumpet player's phrasing does to a rock song, go give it a spin. It's a beautiful piece of work.
It really is. A debut from Lifers.
Thanks for helping us unpack this one.
Anytime.
And to you, listening, check your archives. You never know when you might need them. We'll see you on the next deep dive.